migrants, Muslims and trans rights. Pauline Hanson's conservative credentials on the world stage as the government promises to fight Islamophobia and the worst effects of the AI revolution. I'm Patricia Carvelis. Welcome to Insiders. Pauline Hanson has addressed the UK Conservative faithful overnight with fresh attacks on immigration, climate action and trans rights.
And then in Australia, we've gone completely woke. In Australia, you can't determine who's a male and female. You can't say that.
It's the latest stop on a European tour courting controversies from an audience with a far-right activist and a resort holiday with Gina Rinehart. Back home, the government has delivered its long-awaited response to Islamophobia, avoiding a key demand from Australia's Muslims. The PM also outlining a new approach to AI with tougher rules on data centres and protections for workers and creatives. But the opposition says it won't write a blank cheque for the plan, demanding more detail and warning about union interference over jobs.
This is our time to decide what AI looks like here in Australia.
The world-leading national framework.
That will force big tech to build their own clean energy grids.
Demanding AI pay a fair price for the content their tools scrape.
If we hang back or stand still, this will just run right over the top of us.
A US tech bro predator industry that's come in here to mine our data.
We deal with dangerous strawberries quicker than we do with the dangers of AI.
Effective today, I'm establishing the Office of AI in my own department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet.
What he's announced is an office in an office, inside his own office.
All poor old Angus Taylor can do is complain.
The answer to this is not more bureaucracy.
It's just juvenile, it's partisan, it's unsurprising.
No government can turn back the clock, nor would we want to.
But it's motherhood statements.
Is the Prime Minister not talking to ordinary Australians how they don't want to hand over the keys to their economy, their data, their government?
The real reason why Anthony Albanese has made this speech now is because he's got his national conference coming up and the union officials will be demanding that they have a right of veto over AI.
Really, we've been told that, you know, it could possibly wipe out all these jobs.
We want AI to support and create good jobs, not replace them.
In fact, the robots could take over.
We need to make sure the government is serious about playing hardball with these big tech bros.
Think about what we have, the space to build, the sunlight to power, affordable, reliable, renewable energy.
We're not going to write a blank cheque for this Prime Minister.
We need to lift that nuclear ban.
What is in it for the Australian people? What do we get out of this?
We can make AI indeed stand for Australia's interests, and I hope to do so. Thanks very much.
Joining us on the panel, ABC writer and presenter Annabelle Crabb, Chief Political Correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Paul Sakal, and Capital Brief's Senior Political Correspondent, Katina Curtis. Welcome to all of you. And we're going to get to One Nation, Pauline Hanson, how significant the last couple of weeks have been. But first on artificial intelligence, Annabelle. This speech by the Prime Minister on Wednesday at Sydney University, the university studied, of course, and was an activist at, was really significant and a U-turn, I thought, on their light touch approach on AI.
Yeah, I think sometimes with governments you see a moment where they go, well, we're trundling along this direction and then suddenly handbrake turn, and this was absolutely one of these. This has been a matter of intense discussion at cabinet level for some time now. The oft-reinforced approach of the Albanese government was to take a light-touch regulatory approach to AI. We know we've had AI giants come here and negotiate and talk with government ministers. What he did this week was to reintroduce the concept of really quite interventionist government controls. And yeah, I do think the timing is a little bit to do with the Labor conference that's coming up within days. More crucially, it's a significant indication from the Albanese government that this sense of exploding, out of control proliferation of AI ramifications is something that he's going to do something about. Now, I actually think that this is a product of some reasonably in-touch people within the government understanding just how quickly this rollout of data centres is going to be, how disruptive it's going to be in communities, and to send a signal straight away that we're in control of that. The question of what you do with information is...
Yeah.
Much bigger.
It's very interesting, Paul. They were going for the lighter touch approach. Now we'll have laws at the start of next year. Are they just on data centres, water and power, or will it be broader?
I'm not... Well, I totally understand the suggestion that it's a super interventionist approach. I think it's... I don't fully agree with it, though. I think that this is more a question of the government looking overseas at the debate on data centres in the US. You've just seen a moratorium in New York, in Virginia, where there's many more data centres. There's a lot of energy around the debate on how much energy and power prices are going up. I think they've looked overseas and said, look, we really want the data centre rollout to be big and broad in Australia. It'll give us a national security advantage, an economic advantage. Albanese was keen to not take the populist route and say that these things can be stopped. He said we need to shape it ourselves. And by putting some rules around it, if you talk to people in the cabinet, what they've tried to do is to say, to tell the country, we need these things, but we need to put some guidelines around it so that they can maintain social licence, so that we don't see the kind of backlash you've seen in the US, but we need to do this quickly too.
Yeah.
So they've tried to strike a balance. I don't quite think it's a super interventionist approach that's meant to slow it down. It's meant to speed it up in some ways, but with a sense of control.
Do you think Enyusik this week is feeling a bit like, well, that's what I was saying the whole time?
I think he is, but it's not quite his approach, although it is more interventionist than that.
It's not quite as far as what he wanted to go. Everyone's been at pains to say it's not this big EU-style AI act across everywhere. To your question before about was this just about data centres, I found that actually a bit confusing coming out of the PM's speech. You definitely could walk away with the impression that these new standards would be just about basically like planning and building code rules for data centres. As I understand it, there is going to be some safety stuff in there as well. I'm told that the priorities for safety and AI, the priority areas, will be released soon to imminently, whatever that means. Keep an eye out in the next few weeks, I think. The copyright stuff may end up in those standards, kind of depending on how the work that Michelle Rowland is doing goes. And the other thing is that the digital duty of care that they've promised by the end of the year, I mean, that will cover AI chatbots, Nudify apps, a lot of those sorts of things as well. So there is work in that space coming too. But yeah, I think it's definitely moved further than they were talking about even in May when they released the expectations, but
I asked for ministers at the time, are you going to legislate?
Yeah.
No. And now they're legislating, right?
So there has been a shift. They have shifted, but
I don't know. It's become more muscular for sure.
Also, one other thing that's happened in that interim, which I'm sure feeds into it at some level, is that Anthony Albanese and Annika Wells have installed this social media ban that's basically taken them on a world tour, right? They have enjoyed, I think, that sense of being the first movers. I would be surprised if that hasn't kind of fired the Prime Minister up a little bit to be a world leader on this front as well.
Yeah, and there's an AI arms race, isn't there, really? And China and the Chinese president has given a really significant speech.
Yeah, this was last week. I mean, the Chinese president doesn't often give speeches that are made public, so that was in itself a sign of how important the Chinese administration is viewing this issue. And on the AI arms race between China and the US, we link into this arms race quite significantly. We're one of the biggest centres for data centre investment. Australia is trying to... Part of what the Prime Minister was trying to do last week was set the framework up in a clear and coherent way to attract investment from Microsoft, Anthropic, OpenAI and others. In particular, Anthropic, which is now the biggest AI firm, wants to invest about $50 billion Australian dollars in Australia to make Australia a key second home, they call it, for training its model. Mm-hmm. The idea on the Australian side is that this is turning into, if not the most important, at least one of the most important national security questions. And by enmeshing ourselves in the US system, we potentially give ourselves first user advantage on the frontier models. And even and in a, at a second layer, if we find ourselves in a world where there are sovereign AI models built, which will take a huge amount of investment that Australia is not currently putting in, but by building the computing power in Australia through these data centres, we might put ourselves in an advantage to create our own models. So,
and to have it trained on, to have the existing ones trained on Australian data. You know,
right.
People talk about the biases you get by, you know, the algorithm or the AI is only as good as the data that goes in.
Exactly.
So if we make sure that it's getting Australian data into it, it brings an Australian viewpoint
totally.
To whatever
and
it's bringing out.
Sorry, just finally on China, which I missed. The comparative advantage that you get from building out your compute across the world is extraordinary. The White House is very worried about the Chinese build-out of compute. They obviously don't have NIMBYs in China. They can just build. Australia's a big
command and control structure is quite useful, isn't it, for such things?
And there's been reports from OpenAI that China is using bots around the world to foster antipathy towards data centres in the West to slow down the West's build-out. It's a critical question.
This thing is happening at warp speed as well. One, this new grouping that the Chinese president kind of announced, which is involves Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, Russia, is about a new consensus of developing and shaping AI. And it's...
Like, we'll give it to you for free, well, you know, like,
right?
So that they want to be part of it.
So what's that about, right? But the Chinese model also is about really strict restrictions on human interaction. I mean, they've recently outlawed companion bots on which people develop an emotional dependence because it's affecting the birth rate. Now, let's have a look at what's happening on the other side of the arms race, though. Donald Trump, who's obviously been doing everything he can to just open all of the floodgates and let... because he loves the stock price boom, right? But there's... in the new book by Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman called Regime Change, to which I am unscratchably addicted right now, there is an interaction in 2004, only 2 years ago, between two OpenAI executives who visit Trump, who has never sent an email, they report, and has only been texting for 2 years, hasn't really, doesn't know much about AI, but knows that he fears it.
Knows how to tweet.
They, yes, that's right. They show him... they open up ChatGPT, take one of his executive orders and get it to translate it into a poem. He is overwhelmed, thrilled, and he is on board from that moment. That was 2 years ago. So that is the kind of impulsive thinking.
And right, you know, in the minutes we've spoken, AI has improved itself like a zillionfold.
Oh, that poem exaggerating, better tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And the legislation's not till the start of next year, and that poses questions too. Look, it's time now to talk to Shadow Housing Minister Andrew Bragg. But first, this week, Liberal Party President and former Prime Minister Tony Abbott weighed in on multiculturalism with a speech posted on social media.
Multiculturalism has failed, and diversity is indeed not our strength, when numerous Muslim leaders seem less interested in condemning that atrocity, the worst ever terrorist attack on our soil, and in chiding the public about the dangers of Islamophobia, even though there are some parts of Islamic thought that are hardly compatible with life in a liberal democracy.
Andrew Bragg, welcome to Insiders.
Good morning.
Tony Abbott was your former Prime Minister. He's now the Liberal Party's president. He says multiculturalism has failed. Is that helpful and is he right?
Well, I don't agree with that, and I'd make the point that liberalism has actually created multiculturalism because it creates a framework for people to have freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. And the Liberal Party built modern Australia. If you look at the Menzies government opening up after the war, the Holt government abolishing parts of the White Australia policy, and then, of course, Malcolm Fraser's actions to promote multiculturalism and introduce things like the SBS. So we have a very proud record to stand on, and I think it's very important that we're clear about that.
OK, well, here's your Liberal Party president. That's a pretty inflammatory video by some people's standards. I'm sure others agree with it. Is it helpful as you try to pitch what you've just said to voters?
Well, I don't agree with those comments, and I think it's very important that as leaders in the parliamentary party, that we're clear about what multiculturalism is and how it fits into a liberal framework and how it fits into modern Australia. And if people have concerns about certain things in Australia, whether that be around terrorism, forced marriages, other things like that, those are things which are illegal under Australian laws, and those things are not multiculturalism.
They're not multiculturalism, but they're being framed as multiculturalism. Is that dangerous?
Well, they're very different things. The great thing about multiculturalism is that you can subscribe to the Australian nation, its laws and its culture, but you can engage in cultural practices as well, and that is not a reflection or in no way similar to the issues that have been flagged, which are very serious issues, around where certain parts of the community have engaged in violence against other parts of the community or have sought to do things which are illegal, such as forced marriages.
Would you like Tony Abbott to stop doing these things, stop saying these things?
Oh, look, I'm not his spokesperson.
But he's the president of the Liberal Party, Andrew Bragg.
He's a former Prime Minister, he's entitled to his views, and I strongly disagree with them.
OK, I want to move to the response from the government on Islamophobia. They announced that yesterday. A couple of announcements out of it. The government will review the curriculum to strengthen racial and religious tolerance. It's also committing to a research institute on Australian Muslim affairs. Do you support those things?
We've only seen the response in the last 24 hours, and we're very open to it. And I make the point that, unfortunately, inside a multicultural society, you do sometimes see instances of wrongdoing against small parts of the community, as we saw in COVID-19 against Asian Australians. And where there are issues, they should be addressed. I make the point that the biggest issue we've seen in the last few years has been anti-Semitism against Jewish Australians. And that, of course, has warranted a Royal Commission now in the wake of the Bondi atrocity. Mm. And that, of course, has been the biggest part of our work in this area.
OK, so do you think Islamophobia is a serious issue and do you support the government broadly addressing the issue?
It is a serious issue, but I make the point that the only Australians that have to live in cages are Jewish Australians, and that's why there's a Royal Commission on the back of a massacre against Jewish Australians who were commemorating Hanukkah at Bondi Beach.
Pauline Hanson's been on the international stage. I know you haven't missed it. How could anyone? She says there are elements of Islam that are based on terrorism. What do you make of that?
Where people of the Muslim faith have engaged in acts of terror, they've done so on the basis of a mutation in their own mind. The very vast majority of Australian Muslims have no interest and would entirely reject the idea of taking up arms against their fellow Australian citizens.
And so when Pauline Hanson says things like this, do you think it makes Muslim Australians less safe?
Oh, look, she'll do or say anything to tee off against minority interests. She's made a business out of teeing off against minority interests, and I think it's very regrettable, but it's free speech as part of our society. She's allowed to hang out with whoever she wants to hang out with on her European holiday.
But do you think she has questions to answer on that European holiday? Who funded it? Questions like that?
That's a matter for her. I'm not into this sort of tit-for-tat stuff, really. I just make the point that a serious political party would have costed policies for the election. They have very few costed policies. As Angus has already outlined, if they were the government tomorrow, the country would be even more bankrupt than we are now. And, you know, who she hangs out with and what she does in Europe is really a matter for her.
OK, so given you think the country would be more bankrupt, how could you possibly do a preference deal with One Nation? Are you opposed to such an idea?
Well, of course. I mean, we will always shoot for majority government and we reject a large part of the agendas of both the Labor Party and the One Nation Party.
Yeah, but you've denounced Pauline Hanson's approach to minorities. Does that make her more dangerous because of those comments? And does it make you more apprehensive about doing a potential preference deal with One Nation?
Well, I'm also very apprehensive about Anthony Albanese and his communist government, where he has introduced a 30% tax on everything. He's raised regulation to the roof, and he has governed for vested interests over these last 4 years.
But I asked you about Hanson
all
and a
policies
deal?
In Australia. Well, I think that they're both terrible. I think Albanese is terrible.
Which one's
I
more terrible?
I think Hanson is terrible. I mean, they're both as bad as each other. It'd be a coin toss. I mean, I just think that they're both very bad. And that's why we are taking our responsibility very seriously of being a party of government that can win an election across all of Australia, because I think that people are relying on us to be our best selves and to have that very strong policy agenda that can win over the majority of Australians.
One more question. Hanson, Pauline Hanson says Australia is stupid for giving rights to transgender people and we should learn from the UK and there's only men and women. You've been actually a big advocate in the Liberal Party for trans rights. What's your reaction to comments like that?
Well, I think we have to be sensible about these things. I mean, we have men and women, we have other people, and the reality is that if you want to have a free and fair society, then you don't go out of your way to make life harder for people who are in a small minority. That's always been my view, that in public life you should try and use whatever power you have to make life easier for people, not harder. Now, in terms of the trans community, it's a small community, and I just don't accept the view that Pauline Hanson expresses that it's some great risk to Australia. Where there have been issues, they should be addressed. But the idea that there's a spectre of transgender people taking over Australia, I just think is insane.
I want to move to AI because it's huge and it's going to change our economy and everyone's lives. It already is, really. The government has announced that it will legislate, particularly around data centres, but it's going to be broader, it seems. You've warned about overregulation. Do you support the government's changes?
I mean, who knows what they even mean? I mean, of course everyone agrees that data centres should try and use water and power responsibly. But, I mean, this is from a Prime Minister who 2 months ago announced the world's biggest tax on individuals and capital, with the highest taxes in the OECD now on people who are in the pay-as-you-go system and through capital gains. So that's going to push away a lot of the good ideas that would have been developed in Australia inside artificial intelligence. And so I just think we're becoming a very uncompetitive country in the main on artificial intelligence. And if you want to play around with these effectively approvals, these are things that are mainly done at the local level or state level anyway.
OK, but the government is going to have a sort of national COAG, well, it used to be COAG, apologies, I'm old, national cabinet approach. So talk to
God
me...
help us.
Yeah, I know. Talk to me about that. Do you actually support laws which force these big data centres to actually generate their own energy and minimise water? Enforceable laws.
That's fine, but everyone agrees with that. It's like saying, do you want to have a sunny day? I mean, of course, that's a nice concept, but if they put it inside the EPBC framework, for example, it will take 8 years to get an approval, like it does in Australia if you want to get an oil or gas or renewable energy project off the ground. I mean, we are a country which takes forever to get things done. Australia is closed for business under this government. We now have a very punitive tax system, which is going to push away a lot of the ideas that would have been developed in Australia. I mean, we want to have the next Afterpay or the next Canva to be developed here. But even Robin Denham, who did the review for the government on the R&D tax offset, is saying the government stuffed it up. So, I mean, these guys couldn't run a bath on tax policy, which is the main game here in the artificial intelligence world. And I just have no confidence that they're going to be able to deliver anything that's going to be growth accretive. You've got productivity in the toilet. You've got a very anemic economy, very high interest rates, very high inflation. I mean, this economy is very sick, which is why people are going bananas.
But you're not going to stand in the way of these laws?
Sure, I mean, it just doesn't make a big difference. At the end of the day, these are just nice things to have.
OK, well, we didn't have those things, though. So it is significant in that sense. In Queensland, they're not requiring... the Chris Foley government isn't saying you've got to get your own power if you want a data centre. Is that the wrong approach? Should they be required to?
I think if they could provide their own power, that's a good thing. Don't forget that the companies will want to have the highest computational capacity with the lowest environmental footprint. So using renewables, using nuclear, using whatever you can get, which is clean and sustainable, is going to be the main game. Now, the fact that the government have allowed our uranium to be, again, exported to India, but are not using it for domestic purposes, shows how dumb and stupid they are. I mean, they run this government based on some sort of an ideology which is mainly about shoveling out money to their best mates of the unions and the big super funds. And if you look at the policy package in overall, most of it makes no sense.
OK. On workers' rights, are you concerned that workers will be displaced by AI? And are workers entitled to worry about that?
If you look at the history of technology, it's created more jobs than it's killed. I'm confident that there will be a huge AI industry where people will be working in compliance and doing other things that don't exist today, that will exist tomorrow. So I think we have to be open-minded about the opportunities of AI. Of course, the idea of having data centres here in Australia is good, but I'll just make the point that I think we can do better than just being a base for data centres. I mean, we're already a quarry. Data centres are good, but we should be trying to have some of the next best AI companies that can be tools for business, tools for individuals. And I just fear that with the Albanese government's terrible tax policies, with the highest CGT in the OECD and now the highest pay-as-you-go income tax system, we're not going to have these opportunities in Australia. They're going to be in Singapore or in Silicon Valley.
You're the shadow housing spokesperson. Are you prepared to go to the next election telling young Australians you're going to restore negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount?
Of course, because we don't think that higher taxes will create more houses. And the problem we've had in this country is we have had not enough houses built. This government has collapsed supply by 30,000 houses a year. Mm. Meanwhile, they have had a massive expansion in migration. And then they've had the 5% deposit scheme, which has pumped prime prices at the bottom end and made it less affordable for younger people. The main game in housing is to do whatever you can to get the houses built. And these guys are actually deliberately reducing housing supply, including, like in the last session of Parliament, by abolishing the ability of SMSFs to build new houses.
Do you think the capital gains tax discount should be higher than the old 50%?
I would be looking, and we are looking for ways to reduce taxes on housing. 50% of the cost of a new house goes in government charges, taxes and fees. Yeah. So the last thing we need is a 30% CGT on housing and winding back.
But do you still, because you've raised it before, that 50% discount, you think the discount should be higher still?
I think we should be trying to find ways to cut taxes. I would be reducing capital gains. I would be finding ways to reduce other taxes on housing because we need more of them. I mean, all you need to do is look at this government's record. They're spending $80 billion on housing to build 30,000 houses fewer a year. I mean, these guys are beyond incompetent. If I had $80 billion, I would be building at least 250,000 houses in this country every year.
OK, on house prices, there was this poll that came out this week. 61% of people supported a decline in property prices. That means people are prepared for the changes we're seeing, it seems, if you look at this polling. Do you support a fall in property prices?
The main point here is that the government have brought in 400,000 people a year over the course of their government, and they have built 30,000 houses fewer a year. Then they've unleashed the 5% deposit scheme that has pushed up prices by 20% over the course of their government. So they have really pumped prime prices, particularly in a punitive way for younger people. So I think some of that should go back to younger people, because when you look at house prices as a multiple of salaries, 15 times in Sydney, for example, the prices are too high. So I think we want to be working for affordability of housing.
So house prices should go down.
Well, I make the point that they have had a huge influx of migration, a huge collapse in housing supply, and then these 5% reckless deposits without means testing or price caps. And what that has meant is they have pushed up prices. They've pushed up prices. They haven't dealt with the productivity issues like CFMEU.
Now prices look like they're in decline. Do you support that? Do you like that you're seeing house prices on the decline?
So for younger people, some of that should be returned to younger people, because prices are too high in Australia for young people who are looking at, in some cases, 15 times a multiple of their salary to buy a first house. That is not fair. It is not reasonable. And so that's why I think our policies must be focused on affordability over the longer term, which is really about how do you get a quarter of a million houses a year built every year in this country? We used to get 200,000 houses a year under the Coalition. Now we get 170,000 houses a year under Labor, despite their massive investment and Albo and Claire O'Neill's bragging about how much money they're spending. Just because you spend more money on housing doesn't mean you get more of it.
Andrew Bragg, many thanks for joining me on a Sunday morning. Appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. See you.
Coming up, high fashion, far-right activists and a White Lotus getaway with her billionaire bestie. Pauline Hanson's European vacation done One Nation style. First, let's bring in our panel, the ABC's Annabelle Crabb, Paul Sakal from The Age and the City Morning Herald and Katina Curtis from Capital Brief. Annabelle, on housing, if we can start there and unpack that interview. I mean,
sure.
It's pretty clear that he does think that housing prices should be more affordable.
Yep, and there is an appreciable group of people in the Australian population who are happy to see that exponential increase in house prices flatten out. Interestingly, you know, before the last election, we were talking about supply being the major issue with housing, and I think that Andrew Bragg is absolutely right that the government's not going to hit its very ambitious targets for building houses. Now, that's for heaps of reasons that were pretty evident straight up from the beginning and are still there. But isn't it interesting now that we're talking about something else? We're talking about house prices because of the tax changes in the election, the broken promise that the Albanese government made. It's almost as though we've switched our attention away from that supply issue, which does continue to be the major one.
Absolutely.
And it's not moving.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some data during the week as well. I totally agree with your point, Annabelle, on supply. It's not on the agenda. There was some data during the week from, I think, from Equifax, who've looked at loan data. So house prices are falling, and were falling before the tax changes. Perhaps it's been accelerated. But loan takeouts of loans from all people, investors and first home buyers, have dropped. The quickest drop-off in people taking out loans are first home buyers. So government MPs will be citing anecdotes from people at auctions, young people saying, oh, I've got a leg up and I feel like I'm in the market now. But anecdotes don't make data, and the economic circumstances, high interest rates, create an environment that's no good for first home buyers or investors.
And I think, interestingly, just quickly, like on the timing thing and meeting the target, the biggest piece of what the government says is going to be the biggest bang for buck in its Homes for Australia plan is the $10 billion thing to unlock 100,000 first homes, homes for first home buyers. Now, that 100,000 will actually be, they reckon there'll be about 300,000 homes built because the developments are bigger than just the ones just for first home buyers. But they're running around doing all these agreements with states. They haven't got all the states on board yet. And that is actually over an 8-year time frame. So it's going to take us well beyond their mid-2029 deadline. So, you know, they're saying that's the biggest kind of bang for buck piece of that housing plan and getting the supply happening, but it's in a much longer time frame than what
there is. A Productivity Commission inquiry that's report back quite speedily on housing supply. So, well, maybe that's the next phase of the government's agenda.
That'll be interesting to see. Look, I want to pivot to an announcement yesterday at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. I'm making a lot of that because it's not really the top news time for the world. The Labor government issuing its response to the Islamophobia report that was actually landed 10 months ago. A lot's changed since 10 months ago. They've adopted 35 of the 55 recommendations, but actually ignored, Annabelle, some of the more contentious ones, it seems. What do you make of it?
Releasing something on a Saturday is always a bit of a tell. The Prime Minister was there, but it wasn't particularly widely flagged. I think you could absolutely say that the release of the response to the Islamophobia report is not as prominent as the response to the anti-Semitism challenges. I think that the Prime Minister and the government more broadly is softballing slightly at the moment because of this discussion that we're having, fueled in part by One Nation, aided by Tony Abbott. And I think that what's playing out in Australian politics is a really solid demonstration of the issues that inquiry investigation was formed to examine. It's an extraordinary thing. And I know that we'll get on to Pauline Hanson shortly, but I do think what's happening in Australian politics right now is that there is this extraordinary and not fact-based connection of different factors in our immigration system. There is, they take the numbers, 400,000 people a year at the peak, and then it rolls straight into we're being swamped by Muslims, which is what Senator Hanson says, and then we move straight into Sharia law and what Muslims believe in. Now, there are two enormous logical leaps inherent in that tale that is being retailed in a really simplistic way. One, the vast majority of immigrants and the numbers of immigrants coming into this country are not Muslims. The big growth has been in Indian and Chinese immigrants.
The Indian population overtook the English, those from England.
Mm. Right. But from what you're hearing, you could infer that Australia is importing hundreds and thousands of Muslims a year, all of whom believe in Sharia law. Mm. Now, to be absolutely clear, Sharia law, polygamy, forced marriages are not legal in Australia and continue
to be. So, Paul, that is absolutely right. And actually, interestingly, Andrew Bragg really distanced himself, didn't he, there? I thought that was probably, in my view, the most significant part of that interview from the Tony Abbott perspective on that, and even some views that some people have about Islamophobia and whether it exists.
Yeah, I think there's a question here about whether these envoys are helping. People in the government are questioning this. I mean, the Islamophobia envoy, one of his key recommendations that was not adopted by the government, was changing the terrorism definition to remove religious motive. To make that recommendation only months after the terrorist attack we saw last year was, I mean, the government would have been mad to even consider it. On the other hand, Gillian Siegel, the anti-Semitism envoy, has been calling for regulatory bodies to oversee reporting in the ABC, which would lend itself to, I think, plausible criticism that that's quite an illiberal approach. The anti-Islamophobia envoy called, I think, last week for both positions to be cast away and to create a social cohesion envoy. I know that's a buzzword and it's bored people. And I'm aware that the anti-Semitism envoy came from a position of a view that there is a special historical circumstance for anti-Semitism.
And the government's response came faster because of the Bondi terror attack.
That's right.
Can I just say, don't take from my remarks that I don't think that anti-Semitism is a problem.
Oh, of course.
And
it's huge.
Also, I think that it is possible for all these things to be true at the same time, right? And there is an extraordinary problem with anti-Semitism in this country, and we're right to respond strongly to it.
Yeah, these envoys, though, you're right. And Katina, I mean, that's the thing, right? You know, the government's trying to balance all of this.
Yeah, they seem
it's difficult for them.
They seem to have gone around about their job in quite different ways. They, as Paul points out, they've landed in different places, and it sort of makes you wonder what instructions they got, or maybe not very much instruction at all in what their job was and how to do it. And definitely, I mean, the huge contrast in the way that the government has released this response compared to, you know, the Prime Minister and Gillian Siegel stood up in the Prime Minister's courtyard at Parliament House with the Canberra Press Gallery on a weekday to release her response. Like, and this one looks very much like they were sort of trying to hide it.
Yeah, it seems to me very much centred, though, but around the Bondi terror attack. Yeah. But I want to move the conversation, if we can, on to the story everyone's talking about. Let's be honest, you can't miss it today. Pauline Hanson might be 17,000 kilometres away on a European working holiday, but if her political opponents thought that might keep her out of the headlines this week, they were seriously mistaken.
Well, haven't I heard when the cat's away, the mice will play?
Pauline Hanson and her benefactor, Gina Rinehart, spotted poolside at a luxury hotel.
Oh, I saw that. One of those images you don't want in your head.
There's been six members of Parliament that were over in Italy this week. But let's have a go at Pauline Hanson.
I don't care if it's Dolce, Cabana or Prada, as long as you're paying for it, darling, I don't care.
Well, I'll tell you something. Not $1 cost to the taxpayer.
This is all about a strategy to look after Gina and the billionaires.
I just see a lot of jealousy out there.
Pauline Hanson has blamed the end of the White Australia policy for the start of what she calls Australia's migration problem.
Well, it started in 1973 with Gough Whitlam. So they opened up and got rid of the White Australia policy. Then they started bringing in the different migrants.
Just beyond the pale.
It's just blatant, disgusting, disgraceful racism.
There are false allegations that I want to introduce the White Australia policy.
not the case. Never, ever have I advocated that. Please explain, Pauline.
Look, honestly, that's a matter for her. I'm focused on Australia and Australians.
Friction behind the scenes.
One of your top staffers has leaked to the SMH that cracks are appearing between the two of you.
Pauline and I are great mates.
How are you going, my mate Barnaby?
You've got the crackpot, Malcolm Roberts, promoting conspiracy theories.
And the question here for Pauline Hanson is, what is she going to do about it? She's over in Italy, living it up, it seems.
I can't believe you, Angus. You actually have a go at me.
Just because one member of one nation says something, it doesn't mean it's policy.
I'll be back in Australia soon.
Katina, it's been a big week for One Nation, big week for Pauline Hanson, the Tommy Robinson interview, then her trip to Sicily and the photos that appear on Instagram, and now she's ended that trip on speaking at CPAC. The optics, have they been unhelpful to her surge?
Look, I think it is quite telling. You've played snippets of both of them there. She released two very defensive videos on social media, kind of pushing back at the criticism that she's receiving back in Australia. So maybe the whole thing has landed quite differently than how she thought or hoped that it would. Definitely, you know, the fact that Nigel Farage says, well, I wouldn't have spoken with Tommy Robinson, you know, convicted criminal, thug, white supremacist. Like, so even Nigel Farage, who Hanson has really tried to align herself with, I think is saying that's a step too far for me. That's probably not helpful to her, not encouraging. It sounds like her big speech at the CPAC overnight, the room was sounded like all, about a quarter full. So, you know, probably not the reception she hoped there.
Yeah.
And it also sounds like, according to her explanation on social media, she didn't enjoy the fashion show that much either.
She said she wouldn't go again because I suppose the optics of that, such a fancy thing, is the kind of elitism, right?
Yeah, well, there's a reason that Pauline Hanson, who posts relentlessly on social media and often in a very smart way, didn't post about the Sicily trip. The Sicily element was in between the ARC conference in London, another Conservative conference, and CPAC. She had a break and she went and met Gina Rinehart in Sicily. The trip has been a disaster, and that's acknowledged internally, very firmly internally. They've wanted to come back for days. The doco, which people can watch on, shouldn't be promoting, but Spotlight tonight on Channel 7 has fallen apart. There's a breakdown in communication between 7 and One Nation. The Nigel Farage meeting they were meant to have at the start of the trip fell over because Farage sparked a by-election and had other things on his hands. I think there's a couple of things happening to One Nation at a macro level since about the National Press Club. Even people who aren't paying close attention because we're not near an election have started to, you know, slowly think about Hanson as a prime minister, and that increased her salience, and people have, without looking at the detail, just looked at messiness in One Nation, and that's dragged her down. So, then at a micro level, some of these, you know...
So the images are wild, of course. And, of course, you know, salacious. People like reporting on them, and, you know, anything that happens on Instagram is often... that you don't want out is interesting. But... what I think is really interesting is that back home, Annabelle, we've got the Malcolm Roberts, you know, unearthing of comments he's made. He's a senator for One Nation. A lot of it conspiracy theories, chemtrails, like incredible stuff. Questions on that. And then reporting that Barnaby Joyce and the One
Malcolm
Nation
Malcolm Roberts is a man who dances to his own drumbeat. And I think, you know, the extent to which at the extremes these debates can get incredibly messy is perfectly demonstrated by the fact that Pauline Hanson leads a party that argues we're being swamped by Muslims, that has a senator who's prepared to entertain the idea that Bondi was an inside job, which is one of the most repellent things I've ever heard in this country. And I think that most normal Australians feel as devastated by the idea of this terrorist act happening on our land than as we feel about the persecution of any decent people, right? So, I don't know, Katina, I don't know that I necessarily agree that the defensive videos are a sign of, you know, an acknowledgement of a misstep. I mean, we've got to remember that Pauline Hanson, above all, is a 30-year entrepreneur in the attention economy. It's what she's great at, right? Saying or doing something highly challengeable, being challenged broadly and loudly and on every available platform, and then saying, everybody's having a go at me. Mm. Everybody's being unfair. I didn't say I wanted to reintroduce the White Australia policy. I just said it was a pity it had been abolished. I mean, this is all part of the churn, and we're all contributing to it as well, by the way.
And that's because she's polling so high, right? Mm. That's why is a focus.
Yep.
Because people really want to vote for a party. So then everyone's like, well, what's she saying? Yeah. What's she doing?
But I think the mistake is that the support for Pauline Hanson is not really built on active identification of Hanson as a contemporary orthodox political leader with a party. She barely has a party room. I mean, sometimes I think Angus Taylor must look at him and think, shit, that would be fun, wouldn't it? Like, just say whatever you want and not have these jerks all around you trying to undermine you, you know. She's only got half a dozen. It must be a lot easier. But the reason behind the rise of Pauline Hanson is not to do explicitly with every policy idea of Pauline Hanson. It's the failures of the major parties. So
that's what it's about. It's kind of their wrecking ball, right? How about the troubles back home? Yes, Malcolm Roberts, but also the Barnaby Joyce, are they having issues? She also addressed that issue, didn't she, Paul, in one of her videos at the back of the car?
Everybody has issues with Barnaby Joyce.
Well, apparently.
Are they having issues with Barnaby Joyce? The blanket answer
apparently Barnaby Joyce called her and said, you're the best leader I've ever had.
Yeah, that's what Hanson said. I think it's more, counter to the general trend of people having issues with Barnaby, I think it's more Barnaby having issues with One Nation at the moment. He's been brought in as, think what you want about Barnaby. He has governing experience, he's led a party, he's been brought in to create a veneer of credibility, and he's come into the show at a time when there was huge hype around Hanson, everything was going well, and as time has gone on, some of the more contentious elements of One Nation's agenda have been put forward, and really, as you said, Annabelle, people have been reminded of some of the really fringe views that exist within One Nation and in Hanson's makeup. And Barnaby, I think, has had a moment of thought and reflection and realised that he's in a machine that is hard to control and may not be as respectable as he thought. And he's trying to steer the train to a position of being able to appeal to a majority, but there are many in the party who are unable to appeal to
him. So, Katina, in terms of succession planning, she mentioned her daughter in one of the...
And then she walked that back again as well.
Well, she didn't... To be fair to her, if you listen to all of it, she didn't say she would be the leader.
She said she had potential.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, look, I think there's actually quite a few Liberals feeling a glorious sense of schadenfreude seeing Barnaby having to be on TV defending this multiple times a week. Look, I think there definitely is an open question about what happens when Pauline leaves, right? It's been well thought for years and years that James Ashby would step into that spot somehow, her close advisor. There are questions around whether Malcolm Roberts will last out his full term in the Senate because of his health. And so who, you know, would Ashby fill that seat? How would that kind of work? So I think that Barnaby Joyce is probably right to be thinking about what's going on, what comes next.
Now, on Tuesday, our very own Annabelle Crabb launches a brand new season of Kitchen Cabinet, sharing lunch with the Prime Minister and some unexpected thoughts on his political rivals.
John Howard understood his party.
Yeah.
He had control of the caucus. Howard as well, I think, understood that the 24-hour media cycle isn't what you have to be focused on. Credit where credit's due. It's a substantial achievement to govern for 11 years.
Annabelle, that was an interesting insight and thank you for the scoop.
You're welcome. I think, the most interesting thing about that interaction for me was just seeing all the degrees of control that are apparent in Anthony Albanese's life from his cooking technique. I'm not even joking. It's quite visible. To his relentless march, I think, from where he was 30 years ago at the beginning of his political career, when he gave, I think, one of the most vicious speeches I have ever heard about a serving political leader, about John Howard. He said that he was pathetic, gutless, that he was weak, that he was, you know, had fixed up his hair and his teeth and got a snazzy pair of glasses but was still the same person. In this interview, he talks about his respect for Howard and the first thing he mentions is the control that Howard had over, he says caucus, which
is a bit
of a Freudian slip. And I think that is one of the most extraordinary things about Anthony Albanese's career. People think he's a bit dull. He's the opposite, because can you think of another individual who has grown up as a left-wing MP, party operative, struggling under the boot of the New South Wales right? He has colonised his party and he rules it with a control I've not seen in a Labor leader.
I have not seen it either. A national conference for the ALP, its 50th, starts at the end of the week coming. That iron grip over the party will be clear there, won't it, Paul?
Yeah, well, the speed of the transformation, it's not just Albanese from student protester to Prime Minister, it's Albanese as of 2015 as the leading kind of activist voice at national conference speaking against Bill Shorten's boat turn back policy, where there were tears on the conference floor. He talked about the caucus being supine and him being the voice of virtue. You know, 11 years on, there's people in the government who are saying this week that they're very pleased that there will not be a single vote of consequence. So the 20 members of the National Executive...
Amazing.
20 members of National Executive, they're all renominated. Oh, there's 20 nominations, so no votes.
Amazing!
No vote for President. And in the briefing that journalists received last week, there's also a strong suggestion that there will be no debates of substance around AUKUS or other matters that will actually require a substantive vote. So quite the transformation.
Paul, it's quite wild.
In this interview, he also says, of his own volition, that he... that the party has learned its lesson on immigration and that he's strengthened the Howard-era border protections and that the UK and US related parties, the Democrats and the Labour Party, have failed to learn the lesson that Labour has, and that's why they're in trouble.
Well, he's really shifted, just final comment before we get to talking pictures, he's really shifted the party really to the right. I mean, I think some in the party would argue everything's shifted to the right, and so Labour's part of that story.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's pretty extraordinary, you know, considering the left has the numbers in the caucus, in the cabinet, in at conference this coming week, that there is that big shift. I wonder if that happiness will last, if the left says, what are we doing here? Mm. Like, we've got the numbers, we can't get things done that we want.
I'm not hearing it at the moment, are you?
I'm not hearing it at all.
Maybe it'll be in 3 years' time.
All right, time for final observations.
At the Labor conference this week, as we were just talking about, the first thing that will happen is Kate Ellis will become the new Labor Party president. The vice presidents under her are Michelle Myers and Rhiannon Douglas. This is the first time in the party's history that's had three women in those top three spots, and comes as a great contrast to the survey that the Liberals sent out to their members and supporters last week, trying to gauge, you know, how people think that where their party should go, included a range of options of what to do to attract more women, including one that was basically boiled down to, it's not important, we don't need to worry about it.
And it was basically dismissed, Katine. Now, before even discussed by the leader, by a couple of other men in leadership.
That's right. Angus Taylor saying, I don't believe in quotas, I never have. Extraordinary.
Yeah, he just completely shut it down. So why do they put it in the discussion paper then?
Well, some people in the party must think it's worth pursuing.
Yeah, it's mysterious though that they put things in papers and then they just don't even want to discuss them.
Why release another party review?
It's unusual.
Victoria has a state election in November. I think it'll be one of the most highly anticipated state elections in Australia in quite a while. The polls at the moment have One Nation, Labor and the Coalition all around 25%. One Nation has no policies, candidates or anyone linked to One Nation except one upper house MP, which is a sign of how pissed off people are with both major parties there. The Liberal Party sorted the Moira Deeming saga on Friday, finally. Mm. There's renewed chatter about whether Jacinta Allen might be rolled over the next couple of months because she's as unpopular as Donald Trump in Victoria, according to polling, and doubly as unpopular as Peter Dutton was before the last election.
That's diabolical for the Labor Party, right? That's like a bloodbath election.
It's diabolical, but Jess Wilson is a young coalition leader. She's untested, she's inexperienced, and there are some federal Labor people who are looking down at Victoria thinking it may be a pretty good thing for federal Labor if the state Labor government loses and the coalition's in government with One Nation, which could be quite a chaotic government and be a sign to the rest of the country that One Nation is not to be trusted in power.
And then do you think that template would work, though? I wonder if Queenslanders notice what's happening in Victoria, really.
It's a good point, but I think the novelty of One Nation being in power and having a potentially cabinet positions would be a big moment at a national level, I think.
Oh, yeah, I think it would be quite seismic.
Victoria's running out of messiahs. Just a quick one from me. People pay out on the Prime Minister for his band T-shirts and his dorky DJing and...
DJ Elbow?
Yes.
One of the best DJs in the country.
Program over age and so on. But seriously, like, that man's continued and genuine interest in Australian music, I think, is quite significantly central to the decision of the government to speak out firmly on the rights of copyright holders and artists. It's a really rare instance, I think, of lobbying from the creative community actually securing a solid announcement of support from a government, and I'm pretty sure it's sort of vinyl related.
And the other part of that is, can you imagine the reaction from Labor's rank and file if they did actually sell out artists? I mean, that is fundamental. Like, that's part of their base, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, let's just not congratulate each other all yet, because we'll wait to see what form that protection takes and how it works. But anyway.
The PM met with Tim Minchin on this question a few weeks ago.
Well,
he's been highly engaged in it, reading the papal encyclical and meeting lots of his Muso friends to talk about this issue.
Well, they do love a Gen X band T-shirt, although I think the PM's officially a boomer, but he's kind of on the cusp.
No, he's a boomer. Yeah, last
he's
boomer.
He's close, though. He's close,
yeah, he
though.
Is. Just. Wow.
Just. But, just.
The other thing I love is how everybody's reading the papal encyclical.
It's the hot new thing. It's the new abundance.
It is the new abundance.
Oh, no, let's not go back to abundance. Thank you. You've been a great panel and made my guest hosting excellent today. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Now, if you've ever dined at the Lodge and been asked to bring a plate, you would know how important it is to research the dish you plan to bring, especially if you want it to be a surprise. Otherwise, things could get awkward. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
I'm making something I know is special to him from his childhood. Wagon wheels. He grew up in the middle of Sydney in a council estate just next to the Weston's biscuit factory.
I still to this day can't really eat wagon wheels because... because the kids had had boxes of them, often given by the Western workers, by the way, so it was all good.
It's a good biscuit, though.
Is it?
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.